No, I only want one. Thank you.
You have a body of North American Rockwell Space Division people, a group of NASA people all in the background, and they're here to help you too a little later.
Okay, give us help.
About a year ago at this time, a group of very talented people representing all skills in our industry, all skills but one, no PR man was involved. They were working on a proposal for NASA, a Study B proposal for the space shuttle. Now, we're in the final quarter of that study. We were fortunate enough to win the competition along with several other companies. And we're in the final quarter, and this gives us the opportunity today to kind of bring you up to date on what we've done, what NASA's done, and the importance of shuttle. Now, when we started our proposal effort, which was a follow-on to some study contracts we had previously, we brought one of our most experienced and talented managers who'd handled our operations at Cape Kennedy. And that was Bastian Buzz, and incidentally that Buzz is B-U-Z, hello. And I'd like to turn the meeting over to Buzz and he will take care of it from there. Buzz?
Thank you. All right, I must light up like a Christmas tree. I think when we look toward the role of shuttle, what shuttle will be doing in the years to come, it's good to go all the way back to ground zero and talk about what are the things that our nation wants to do. Because there's a real tie-in between what our nation wants to do and the role of shuttle. Now, I'd like to start back at that ground zero if I could. Now, just think about these things for a minute. They are three major objectives that a nation like the United States would have. We want to improve the lifestyle and the well-being of every one of the citizens. You can put a lot of things in that. You can put the environment in that. You can talk about his paycheck. You can talk about his the effect of international economics on his particular well-being. I can leave it to your imagination to fill in all the things under that major national objective. Take a look at number two, maintain a free and democratic government. Of course, that's the place that this well taken care of citizen lives in. And the preservation of Western culture. That may sound like some great high-flown phrase, but where else are those Western cultural aspects maintained other than in a country that does keep a free and independent nation? All right, I can relate from those then if I could have the next one. How space applies in each one of these cases, and I think that that relation becomes very, very clear. Balance of payments. It relates directly to the national, international economic stability theme. It relates also to the national security theme. Now, you can see that each one of the check marks there is a relation then between space and our national objectives. Now let's get this down to some things that we can all look at and smell and feel and touch. Here are things that our government does, national goal areas. You can almost see in those cabinet posts, you can almost see the national government maintaining a surveillance of those individual areas. And if you look on the other side, on your right, you can see what the space program really is. Take a look at some of those things. Planetary exploration. You've heard about the bit of sending men or material to Mars. There it is. The lunar exploration. That's the whole Apollo program and any of the post-Apollo lunar exploration work. There they are. Take a look at a thing like astronomy. Now, the business of the space-borne telescope is there, looking at the outer planets. Okay, fine, those are in the world of science. in the world of Earth applications, Earth resources, meteorology, navigation, traffic control, communications, and so on. The whole bit in space is there, including the bottom ones, which are the supporting things. Now let's look at the tie-in between these two. Here is how space, among other things, take a look at the lower right-hand corner, if you will, how space, aircraft surveys, and ground surveys can do these things that I have spread around the periphery here. Now, I'm going to take three examples. I'm going to look at map making and cartography, the geographical thing up there. I'm going to look at weather, and I'm going to look at ocean resources first. It turns out that a Gemini crew photographed the 80% of the nation of Peru in about 3 minutes. Can you imagine what it would take a ground-borne team of photographers to do that? And can you imagine what it would take an aircraft-borne team of mapmakers to do that? Done in 3 minutes. Over here is not Peru, but something very close to our own hearts. This is the city of Phoenix. And if you need a detailed, up-to-date map of the city of Phoenix, here it is. It shows the water, it shows the streets, it shows where the population is growing. All you have to do is compare it to a map you took a year ago, and you can see how your population is growing, where it's growing, what directions. The real estate people, just to name one, can use that. Where are roads required, and so on. Okay, map making. It applies directly. Let's take a look at another one. Now, the National Academy of Sciences has looked at the weather problem, and it's their forecast that more accurate weather forecasting can save the people in this country about $2.5 billion a year. This turns out to be a photograph of a hurricane taken in Apollo 9. And it shows the whirling center of the hurricane, that dot in the lower right-hand corner, that center of swirl. It also shows the direction of motion that this whole hurricane is moving in. And from this, an experienced photograph analyzer can determine the speed, the velocity, and all the things pertaining to a hurricane, and can avoid things like Camille. I think there's a direct tie-in. Okay, that is cartography, weather. Let's take a look at the oceans. Now, some of the things that are important in looking at oceans turn out to be surface temperatures, current patterns, what the minute sea biology is doing. Thanks, that's a great help. Sea state, and that means the height and frequency of the wave pattern. Location of sea ice and shoaling processes. And it turns out that all of those things are very important to not only shipping, as you would expect, but also to the fisheries themselves. Now, over here is a picture of Cape Hatteras. And if you look very closely at that, you can see the shoaling pattern in the water itself. Where does the water go to different depths? And a fisherman need only that kind of information to find out where particular fish schools are located. Now, you've seen these pictures before. I'm sure you've been lambasted with pictures of a photograph from space. But when you really get down to it, there are many things you can do with these photographs, many, many things. Okay, I haven't touched on shuttle yet, but I'm going to. Like I said before, ground surveys, aircraft surveys, space surveys. Why would you use space anyway if you could do it on the ground, if you could do it in the air? You do it for one reason, because it's more economical. And the more economy you can build into the space thing, the more you're going to use it and the better off your people are. The more data they get for a smaller investment. And that's the whole corner of why shuttle. Now let me illustrate that. I've shown over here on your left a sketch of an Apollo going up, and it need not be Apollo, it can be any throwaway booster program. It turns out that that whole system weighs about 6 million pounds. Hardware and fuel and everything weighs about 6 million pounds. All that comes back is one capsule with three men on board. Everything else is thrown away. As a matter of fact, under our present ground rules, even that capsule is thrown away. It is not used again. So all 6 million pounds, less the weight of crew members like Jack, goes. Take a look at the thing next to it, the shuttle. That weighs 5 million pounds, very close. And all that is used up there is the propellant itself. Everything else comes back, save only perhaps the payload, which you'd want to put and leave in orbit. Now, what that means directly is that launching any particular space payload is going to cost you 10% of what it cost before. You're going to save 90% of the launch costs. And I'll bore in directly on the problem. If indeed we are faced with a $3 million, billion dollar per year space budget, how are the citizens going to get more space per dollar? By cutting down on the costs. If you can save 90% of the launch costs, you have more money that you can put into the actual sciences itself. That's the reason for shuttle. Shuttle is not an end in itself. It's not intended to be an end in itself. It's a space truck. It's there to carry payloads, people, hardware, fuel, whatever it is, into orbit and come back again. Not an end in itself. The end really is our total national space program. Okay, now that is what shuttle intends to do. Now I'd like very much to ask Wayne Koontz to come up and tell you what shuttle is. Wayne?
Thank you, Buzz. We have here a picture that shows an artist's concept of what the shuttle system looks like. It's a two-element launch system. The larger element, the booster, flies to an intermediate point in the trajectory. And at that point, then, it becomes rather like an airplane. It drops off, re-enters the atmosphere, and it has conventional air-breathing engines that fly it back to the launch site. So it's available for complete reuse. The second element, or the orbiter, goes on into orbit and performs the mission. And we'll show you a little bit more about that as we go through here. At the end of its mission, of course, then it re-enters the atmosphere, lands like an airplane, excuse me, and it's also available for reuse on subsequent missions. Let's talk for a minute about some of the things that what the space shuttle can do. Buzz has already mentioned it can serve as the launch platform for any payload that the nation wishes to put into space. And, of course, the keynote of the program is it does this at a greatly reduced cost, primarily through the reuse of the launch vehicle. There are many other ways, though, that the shuttle can reduce costs for us. First of all, as opposed to being forced to commit a set of hardware once it leaves the launch pad, as we do today, once the stack has left the pad and started its launch, we're committed. There's no way to get that thing back. In the case of shuttle, we're able to check the satellite on orbit before we release it. If it does not check out, if something has failed due to some anomaly during the launch, or if things have not been engineered properly, we've made a mistake in design and it doesn't work, the shuttle is capable of bringing that payload back, as opposed to abandoning it in space. We can just leave it on board or bring it back on board the shuttlecraft and bring it back for repair or rework. Another element of shuttle capability is the capability to go up into space and retrieve a payload that's already there. If we've experienced a failure in a satellite early in its mission, we can go get it and bring it back and fix it. Closely allied to that is a resurfacing and repair function. In many cases, we feel the best way to fix a satellite or any payload will be to repair a malfunctioning element on orbit. Or in the case of picture-taking satellites, we can go to the camera system, retrieve the film from it and install new film, simply leave the satellite in position and functioning, and bring the product, the film, or the data, whatever may have been taken, bring it home. The shuttle, of course, was originally conceived, or the first germ of the idea came from the idea of supporting a space station. First of all, the shuttle is used to launch the station. We launch it in modules, which are compatible with shuttle size. Subsequently, then, the shuttle is used to carry the crew and the various expendable products that are needed in the space station operation. The shuttle returns the crewmen who have finished their tour of duty. It also returns the data and the film and other things that come back from the space station. The Air Force is looking into the defense applications of the shuttle system, and I'm sure General Phillips spoke a couple weeks ago on this subject, and I won't go into that. The shuttle also has a capability as a mission spacecraft in itself, and we don't fully understand all the uses this might be put to, and we frankly don't fully understand exactly how we might go about that and at what point it's efficient to use the shuttle as a spacecraft as opposed to a delivery vehicle. We are studying that in some depth. But it certainly offers the opportunity to be used as a multi-purpose spacecraft. Also, the shuttle has the capability to perform rescue missions. If any crews, similar to retrieving failed payloads, if we have a crew in some type of spacecraft that gets stranded or is in trouble in orbit, the shuttle is capable of a relatively rapid reaction and launch into space to retrieve that crew or the complete spacecraft. On the right screen now, we have a pictorial representation of what some of these missions look like. this is just simply a pictorial scheme of some of the things I've been talking to you about. Okay. Let's talk for a second about what a mission profile on a shuttle would look like. As you leave the launch site, the vehicles are really a hybrid. They perform as a rocket, a conventional rocket during the boost phase. As we go up, we reach what's called a staging point. At that point, the booster ceases to thrust and falls away from the orbiter. It re-enters the atmosphere and becomes an airplane, truly an airplane at that time. The air-breathing engines then propel it as it flies back to the launch site, where it lands in a conventional fashion on a runway. The orbiter element, or the upper stage, continues on at the initial orbital conditions are about 50 miles perigee, 100 miles apogee. At the end of the first half rev, the orbit then is adjusted up to something like 100 nautical mile circular orbit. From there, we then proceed to perform the mission, whatever that may be. Represented here is a typical rendezvous mission. At the end of the mission, the orbit is conventional, as you've seen in Gemini and Apollo up to date. Reentry through the atmosphere, the orbiter then returns to the launch site, again landing like an airplane on a conventional runway. This gives you a little bit of idea of the size. The orbiter element is around 200 feet long. Mr. Kellett will be talking to you more about the shape of the thing. The booster is shown in apposition to it. On the left screen here, we've shown you a size comparison of the shuttle with some vehicles you're all familiar with. Here we've taken the liberty of setting a 747 on its tail and putting a 707 on its back in a similar position. They're pretty much the same size. Also, by contrast, here's a Saturn V stack that we used to launch the Apollo lunar missions. It's somewhat taller, of course, but now you recognize that in this case, the orbiter vehicle is in parallel to the boost vehicle. If you picked this orbiter up and stood its tail on the nose of the booster, the stack would be almost 500 feet tall. Let me just run through with you for a second what the payload characteristics are. The shuttle is capable of carrying a crew of 2 and up to 12 passengers. The payload bay is cylindrical, 15 feet in diameter and 60 feet long. And we can carry payloads of any size up to that as a maximum. It'll take smaller payloads. It'll carry multiple payloads. In fact, most of the missions that we're studying involve multiple payloads. The weights that we can carry are represented here. We currently are projecting a capability to carry something in excess of 65,000 pounds on a due east launch from a sea level launch site. If we go to an intermediate inclination like 55 degrees, our payload capability is around 45,000 pounds, maybe a little bit more. In a polar mission, we can carry 40,000 pounds. Now, we mentioned here the air-breathing engine system. Now, let me tell you now that the orbiter vehicle is being designed so that it can be operated without air breathers. In other words, it would make a return, an entry, and then a gliding landing on the runway, similar to the way the X-15 operates after its mission. Now, we're not very far into that. What we have done is decide that the orbiter vehicle will be designed to fly any given mission either with or without the air-breathing engines. If we need the payload, then we'll certainly take the air breathers out. And the weight of that system is a little bit less than 20,000 pounds. So on any given mission, we have that kind of change in payload capability. If we're carrying the air breathers, then these numbers are reduced by a little bit less than 20,000 pounds. And of course, we've already mentioned the capability of the orbiter relative to its payload is to deploy it, or to go retrieve it, or to simply dock with it and reservice it. Thank you.
Thanks, Wayne. I'd like next to introduce Al Kellett, who is a chief engineer from North American Study Effort. Al has been working very hard for the last 8 months on the configuration aspects that you've heard. I'd like Al to tell you why you're in this room, why this room instead of some other place. Al?
Thank you, Buzz. Well, we're in this room because this is probably the largest room we have in our facility that we can represent a fairly accurate, full-scale replica of our shuttle, our orbiter shuttle. What we have on the wall here, then, is as if we took the skin off of our vehicle and we're showing you the insides of what the shuttle looks like, the shuttle orbiter. Now, the brown color you see there is the payload compartment. It's 15 feet in diameter and 60 feet long, as Wayne mentioned. The green or aqua color are the LOX tanks, or the oxygen tanks, liquid oxygen tanks. The yellow are the liquid hydrogen tanks. Now you notice there's two of them, two sets of tanks. The larger tanks in the front here, the hydrogen tank, and the larger of the blue tank is used for the main engines to take off from the booster and inject the orbiter into this 50 by 100 nautical mile orbit. The propellant is depleted from that, and then the smaller tanks, the small yellow tank and the small aqua tank in the rear, are used to ignite smaller rockets. In the very, very tail up in the top, you can see another set of rocket motors. These are smaller rocket motors, and they're used then to circularize the orbit either at 100 nautical miles or to go up to the 270 nautical miles. Now, the reason we have two sets of tanks is because the secondary tanks, or the smaller tanks, must be capable of on-orbit supply for 30 days. In other words, the vehicle does have the capability of staying in orbit for about 30 days, and so we have to store the hydrogen and oxygen for that period of time. It would be impractical in that case to store all of that propellant in these large tanks. So the vehicle weighs about 850,000 pounds, and of that 850,000 pounds, some 600,000 pounds are the fuel and oxidizer. Now, once again, for some idea of the size of the vehicle, overhead you'll see an outline of the fuselage and wing section. And you can see this is a rather large vehicle. Now, way up in the nose, above the hydrogen tank then, is the crew station. And you can see up there four people. As Wayne mentioned, we have two pilots that are in the vehicle, and they're the commander and co-pilot. And we have two, what we call cargo masters. These two fellas are used to help deploy the payloads, to help run the manipulator station, and do the other jobs that are required as on the on-orbit missions. Now, the first slide gives us some idea what we do with the other 10 people that Wayne mentioned, with a capability of 12 people on board this vehicle. We have here the crew station, as I mentioned, the four people in the nose, and then we have a module, a passenger module, in the payload compartment that houses the other 10 people. Now, the reason we have the module in there is that most of our missions are really developing payloads into orbit other than people. So it is uneconomical to put all of the people and pay that penalty inside the cabin for 12 people all the time when you only fly 10 to 15% of your missions with a full complement of people. So we actually developed a separate module that goes in the payload compartment to house these 10 people. And as you can see, it has its own waste management system and its own environmental control system, which are different from the main vehicle. Now, the habitable area, and I'll make the assumption that you understand why it's manned. The men in the vehicle actually perform those functions which are necessary to set up the automatic functions. Like during the main rocket burn, the vehicle flies are mostly automatic. The astronauts in there do this type of setup to perform the maneuvers, and then they push the go button and the vehicle performs. They're also there for a very, very important function, and that is a malfunction detection. We have yet been able to develop a computer that can reason, and this is a very good thing. Our astronauts have done an excellent job on that, evident by Jack's Apollo 13 experience. So at any rate, in the front end of the vehicle, we have the habitable area where the four people stay, and right behind that, we have an airlock area where the possibility of going extravehicular activities, either to help repair a satellite or to perform a rescue mission, we have that capability. Directly behind that is what we call an equipment bay. And this area in here, and what we do with that is we store all of the electronic computers and all of the type of equipment necessary to make the vehicle operate in that location. This provides us then a module that's very easy to maintain this equipment. As Buzz mentioned, we're using this vehicle over and over again. We must have the capability of climbing in there and changing boxes without disrupting the whole vehicle. So we've actually set up a pantry of equipment, and the maintenance crews will be able to climb in there then and change boxes within the two-week turnaround time period we have. Now, the full-scale mock-up we built over here, my right, to your left for the most part, represents only that section of the vehicle where the four people are plus the airlock. It's approximately 27 feet long. It's about 11 feet wide and 8 feet tall. Now, we built this mock-up starting a little over 2 months ago in an effort to represent in three dimensions what we in the engineering department do in two dimensions in making our drawings. Now, some of the things we've discovered about this vehicle have occurred fairly recently. We found out that we had a bulkhead in the wrong place, and we did not have enough room for the pilots to climb into their seats. This was particularly true when we rotated this vehicle into the vertical position. What you see right now is the mock-up in the horizontal position. It does have the capability of standing up on its tail, nose up in the air. And you get an entirely different perspective when you climb in that vehicle coming up the back end when it's vertical than it is when it's horizontal. For the last 3 days now, we've had what we call a crew station review. We've had the astronauts, Jack has been here this time, Buzz Aldrin, Jim Lovell, Tom Stafford, and some of the former MOL astronauts have been here, as well as the people from the other NASA centers, both the Marshall Center, the Houston Center, Langley, and so forth. And we've had a critique of this crew compartment in which we present how we fly the vehicle, how the systems perform, relationship to their controls and displays, and then both here at Downey we've had this, as well as down at San Diego at Convair. And the people are back here today, and we're going through these RIDs, or the items for disposition of what we're what changes we plan to make to the mock-up as a result of this review. Now, it's been a real fine engineering tool from a standpoint of the lessons we've learned. Some of the changes we've made to the mock-up as a result of building it, other changes we'll have to take care of in the near future. Such things as the bulkhead I mentioned. This is the bulkhead immediately behind the pilot you see up in the top up there. Also the reach of the pilots overhead, the panels, we've discovered that we've lowered the ceiling too low in that area, and actually it's so close they can't focus their eyes on it to reach the switches. Some of the other things are the windows. You'll notice the small windows by necessity because of the heating on during ascent and entry, we made the windows small. We've also put posts right in the middle of the windows, and when you try to fly this vehicle from a crosswind type standpoint, a landing, the posts get in the way and you can't see the runway, so we're going to have to change some of the windows. Now, the controls and displays that are part of this mock-up are shown over the side here in cardboard, and this is what we call a cheap mock-up. It's made out of a material called Coreform, which is cardboard with a very light foam weight structure inside of it. It can be cut easily, it can be taped together, and you can take photographs of whatever type of drawings you want to represent controls and displays, and you can actually glue them right onto the cardboard. If you don't like how wide it is, you just cut it and add a section and tape it together, as you can see by these tape marks. So this is these are engineering tools, and they do tell us the arrangement of the controls and displays, and we had a few squawks about the way we arranged it. And we've taken a lot of our Apollo experience as far as the controls and displays and added them in here, and we've added a few new things. Now, one thing that we've not used before have been what we call cathode ray tubes, or CRTs, or television tubes, for the controls and displays. Now, if you look at this, and we'll go through the mock-up later on, you'll see that we actually have three of these cathode ray tubes on each side for the pilot and co-pilot, so there's six all together. Some of these we did use on Apollo, the Disky on the Apollo. We have a similar set of... this data can be displayed to the astronauts in the form of these cathode ray tubes in the front just by his selecting whatever system he wants displayed. So from that standpoint, then, the mock-up has performed its job up to the present time of making these arrangements on controls and displays, letting us understand in three dimensions what we normally draw in two dimensions. The future use of this mock-up, in the vertical position, we plan to make cutouts and do some work as far as how do we fasten these boxes so that when the vehicle is on the launch pad and we have a requirement to change a box, we can actually climb in the vehicle and determine what's the best way. We surely do not want to have to remove four screws and have a box drop on a man's head. And as I mentioned before, it's an entirely different perspective when that vehicle is standing upright than it is when it's horizontal. We've also uncovered a few things like our stands that we have to put inside the vehicle, and this is what we'll be working on in the future. So that, I hope, gives you a thumbnail sketch of our display room here as far as the size of the vehicles are concerned, as far as the mock-up and its uses. And with that, I'd like to turn it back to Buzz.
Thank you very much, Al. I think you can see why he's the chief engineer. Now, as Al has pointed out to you, this particular mock-up review has been going on for 3 days. And Al and his people have been presenting this data to, among other people, the astronaut crew that is here with us. Now, Jack has been part of that crew, and he's Jack Swigert. And Jack has consented to take some time out from that activity to give you a few words on his views of the shuttle program. Jack Swigert.
Thanks, Buzz. I hope you bear with me here today because I've got a cold and I'm probably not in the best of voice. But my words are nonetheless as sincere as if I were in fine voice. I would like to give you what I feel is an astronaut's viewpoint of the shuttle, and particularly an Apollo 13's viewpoint. As I look at this wooden mock-up, I see opportunity, capability, capacity, and promise. Now, you may label me as an optimistic visionary, or you may accuse me of being overdramatic. A year and a half ago, I would have thought so. But today, I don't believe I am, because never before in the history of this country has the subject of science and technology been the subject of such controversy. In his new book, Between Two Ages, Brzezinski states that the influence of America in today's world is in the first instance scientific and technological, and is a direct result of the scientific, technological, and educational lead of the United States. And the space program is a true measure of that lead. For in addition to its intrinsic value, it sets the pace for the scientific and technological development that takes place within this country. We don't have to remember back very far to a time when we were second best, only as far back as 1957 the beginning of the space age, when Russia launched Sputnik, followed with the dog Laika, and then sent the first man, Yuri Gagarin, into space. We accepted that challenge, and we built a vast operating base composed of a team of university, government, and industry, all coordinating their efforts in the most complex undertaking ever attempted by man. And in this team, we built a valuable national resource, which today we are wasting just as much as we are exploiting some of our other national resources. Those of us that have had the privilege of viewing the Earth from some thousands of miles away have been impressed with its beautiful hues of blue and brown and white against the black vastness of space. We see no national boundaries. We see no opposing political philosophy, no different religions, just the home of 3 billion people trying to exist and find happiness. Now, when you believe that there are 3 billion people in the world now, and by the year 2000, there will be 6 billion people, it is rather frightening, because that means that we will have 30 years to duplicate our food production that has taken us some 3,500 years to develop. And the space program is a tool that can be applied directly to this problem. And for pollution, is the solution to pollution and the exploitation of our national resources to blindly and arbitrarily stop all progress, to stop making cars, to stop flying airplanes, to stop manning the factories that produce our goods? The answer to these problems, and more important, the prevention of future problems, can only come from facts not well established now, or in many cases not even known. This is science and the application of science and technology, whether it is on space or in Earth. And the space program sets the pace for science and technology in this country. So is it any wonder that I see in this space shuttle the opportunity and capability to improve the quality of life? But now there are those who would have no more of this, those who equate the real meaning of the lunar program with the return of a few lunar rocks. They are those that would have us become a second-rate nation, not only in space, but in aeronautics, in science, and technology. They see little value in research and technology, but the value, the standard of living that we enjoy today is the direct result of the research that's been going on in our laboratories and in the Antarctic, in the void of space, or under the oceans. The worry about the now permeates this nation. We seem to be unwilling and unable to make long-range decisions for our future and then carry them out. If we could warp time and suddenly arrive in the year 2000, where no long-range plans have been made to feed the added billions of people, we will be witness to complete chaos. For how can the youth of today find peace when there are going to be billions of hungry people in the world? Because a man is not receptive to peace if he sees his family starving. So the decisions we make today will test our ability to continue our international leadership. And so is it any wonder that I see in this wooden mock-up the capacity to alleviate human suffering and the hope and the promise of peace? The decisions that we make now must answer these questions. What will happen if we lose the scientific and technological lead that has made us preeminent in the world community of nations? What will be the effect if the balance of scientific and technological power shifts strongly to another nation? And what program will be the replacement candidate that will improve the quality of life? Now, we have no obligation as adults to solve all the problems for the youth of our nation. Our legacy to them must of necessity include many of these such unsolved problems, for that's the way it's always been. But as adults, we have the responsibility and the obligation to provide them the operating base and the tools with which to solve those problems. And the tools are science and technology. And the space program sets the pace for science and technology in this country. And the shuttle is the space program of the 1980s, the tool that our youth will use for the problems that they will encounter. Is it any wonder why I see in this wooden mock-up the opportunity and the capability to improve the quality of life, the capacity to alleviate human suffering, and the promise of peace in the future? The decisions we make today will be the legacy that we leave our youth. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jack. Gentlemen, if you'd like to have some questions of anybody here, Jack or Wayne. Incidentally, Jack mentioned the wooden mock-up and recalls about 5 or 6 years ago we had a reporter, not from this general area, who we showed the wooden mock-up of the Apollo. And one of the, in the story it said, it'll never fly, it's made of wood. Do we have any questions, Don? Well, here's one right...
Yeah. Have you any idea of how much we've lost so far in the space program from the inability to be able to correct spacecraft that failed in space? Has anybody got any figures on this?
No, I don't have any correct figures on it. We have never really attempted to go back through history and say we could have saved that spacecraft, therefore there is $3 million, $9 million, $90 million. It's an interesting point. It really is. Al, do you have any idea of any of those figures?
I believe at one time, Buzz, when we looked at that, it was something like 25 to 40% of some of the launches could have been made successful if we'd had the ability to use a shuttle-type vehicle to go up there and pick up the payload and either stop it from spinning or to replace some component.
Go ahead, Jenny.
I have heard some figures that we could perhaps save 30% of the initial cost of the satellites by the reduction of miniaturization requirements in order to fit them in the small compact cases that they're required in the booster. And I had a conversation with the project manager of the OAO, and he stated that if we had had the shuttle, we wouldn't have lost the $98 million OAO satellite.
Jack, can you tell us what it'll be like to fly this thing from the pilot standpoint?
Jack, this is Don Bain with the Herald Examiner.
Well, let me say, I could describe it in one word, and that would be exciting, because if you look at this vehicle, we're going to have two vehicles going up there together. Coming back down, we'll be at a very high angle of attack, and we'll spread the heating over the large surface of the bottom surface of the vehicle, whereas now we use an ablative heat shield, which melts away. When we get down to lower altitudes, we'll decrease the angle of attack and start moving for a landing at a particular base, and we have a capability of 1,100 miles of cross range in this thing. So we're going to use completely new ideas, in that we're returning from velocities of 25,000 feet per second on down to a landing speed of 175 knots. So this is it's going to be a very interesting and exciting program. One that I think offers a unique challenge for the test pilot of tomorrow.
Jack, I would be interested in the aspect of the air-breathing engines, how the astronauts feel about the necessity or lack of necessity for those in the orbiter.
Okay, our position from the astronaut office and air-breathing engines has been that we would like them until we could... We envision at some point in time being able to land this thing utilizing a high energy approach. But we would like the air breathing engines on the vehicle until we can go through the flight test phase and satisfactorily demonstrate the guidance system and the feasibility of making these high energy approaches. We just don't feel that we can lose a vehicle, and our best chances for success in the program lie with the air-breathing engines for the initial flight phases, and then their removal to increase the payload.
Marvin, you had a question.
Yes, Buzz. I thought I had understood that your station time was 7 days. I heard 30 days mentioned here today, which is correct.
Yes, Marvin. The design of the bird is based on a nominal 7-day mission, but we must make provisions for a 30-day mission. Now, what does that mean to Al Kellett? The insulation on those smaller yellow and aqua tanks then have to be capable of standing heat transfer of up to 30 days, although nominally, from a propellant and a payload standpoint, we are preparing for a 7-day mission.
Does this mean, Buzz, then, that you could keep this spacecraft in orbit for 30 days on an operational mission of some kind?
Yeah, Marvin, let me get right down. The answer is yes, we can. It takes more consumables to keep the bird on orbit for 30 days. And when we do keep it on orbit for 30 days, then the additional consumables come out of the payload figures you see there. Now, that's a lot of engineering-ese talk, but that's the difference between a 7-day nominal and the capability of staying on orbit for 30 days.
Thank you.
Will there be any change in the ground support team? Will it still be the same size as now, or will there be any money saving?
Well, we figure that a change in the requirements of mission control due to the autonomy capability of this vehicle will offer significant savings, and we won't require large numbers of personnel monitoring the mission for continuously. So we feel that this is one of the savings that we're going to incur due to the autonomy of the vehicle.
Could you explain for me the present state of your finances? Your go, you know, that's a real one.
Slim. How about that, Slim? Let me talk about the contract dollars that we have from the Manned Spacecraft Center. In about the 1st of July, we won the Phase B contract that we're working on right now. The contract value was $8 million, and that was split up among the team members on North American's team. And those were American Airlines and Honeywell and IBM and General Dynamics working the booster. Shortly after that, we got a $2 million supplement that was aimed at doing structural test work, taking specific examples of structure on the bird and building them and testing them at elevated temperatures or elevated stresses or whatever the particular condition was. And then in very close sequence to that, we got a study program directed by the Air Force but funded through NASA, if you will, for $300,000 to look at DOD implications of the mission. We then got a $500,000 study to look at the implications of putting much larger payloads in orbit by putting a stage like the S2 stage on the booster in place of the returnable orbiter. If you want to get massive payloads in orbit, you would do a thing like that, use a throwaway second stage. Now, very recently, we're in the process of getting an additional $750,000 to look at a variation of this configuration to study its aspects. And all told, if my arithmetic comes out right, that's in the order of $11.5 million of contract funding over a period that is very close to a year, maybe slightly in excess of that, but very close to a year. And those are the condition of my visible finances.
Will $100 million that's in this next budget be enough to carry on what's being done and what needs to be done?
Yes. It's a matter of desire, of course. $100 million would be split up very, very roughly, for shuttle, that is, in the present budget, would be split up very roughly, half for the engine and half for the vehicle, the engine being the main propulsion stage back there. And
if indeed NASA goes through the selection process that they have on their mind right now, a contractor for the vehicle should be named this coming spring, a year from now. And the $50 million for the vehicle will be adequate money to begin the program for that fiscal year, right, from about April to the 30th of June of that year. $50 million would be adequate.
You're talking about the orbiter or the booster or both?
Both.
Mr. Hillel,
all other than the engine.
What to you are the important differences between your space shuttle design and that being developed by the McDonnell Douglas company?
Hey, let me be direct on that. We think we have an excellent company to do this, and McDonnell Douglas has an excellent company to do this. The designs proceed along some lines, the rules of which have been laid down by NASA. They want certain things. Now, engineers look at things in slightly different ways. There are slight differences between the design we have and the design that McDonnell Douglas has. I don't see a vast amount of difference between them. Directly, our design can do the job, and directly, McDonnell's design can do the job.
Was there then a duplication of effort, and was it necessary?
No, sir. No, sir. Why does a rich man put half his money in one bank and half in another? The government is they want to get ideas from both contractors, and they are getting ideas from both contractors, and we're both contributing to what is going to turn out to be a single design in the end. Both of us are contributing. Now, we have smarts that are maybe a little bigger in some areas, and Mac has smarts that are a little bigger in other areas. And you've left out another character in the story, and that's the Grumman Company and a few other companies that are around, including our partner, General Dynamics.
That was a good analogy, the rich man putting his money in two banks. Is the space shuttle then actually money in the bank and not money being spent?
You're hitting me where my own feelings are. I think so. I am convinced of it. I am convinced that what this nation has to get in these times of stress, the stress of all the things you know about, you know, the fighting in the streets and the college campus bit and the unrest all over, require funds from the federal government. That means that the space program is going to have to do with the funding that it's getting. And if that's the case, we'd better find a way to get more space for the buck, or we're going to dry up. We're just flatly going to dry up. So I think the shuttle is not just an interesting kind of a program for a lot of engineers to get their fingers damp on and play around with. And I've heard it said in some quarters that this is a play toy of NASA's. It's hardly anything of that sort at all. I tell you directly, it's a truck. It's a truck. It's going to wind up in 15 years, 20 years, 10 years, whatever the number of years, it's going to wind up being a vehicle that is merely there to carry space loads into space.
Jack, will the pilot of the shuttle be a different breed than the astronaut of today?
Well, this, of course, the crew on this one consists of a crew of two and two cargo, what we call cargo specialists. And I envision the crews being of two different types of categories. I think the people that are concerned primarily with the piloting of this vehicle into orbit will be much the same as the breed that we have now. But the other members of the crew, whether they're scientists up there to perform a mission, cargo handlers engaged in space station resupply, I believe they'll come from a different breed of astronaut. Because I feel that if you're going to want to do science, you're not going to find a scientist when it has a PhD and 2,500 hours of jet time and has 20/20 vision. So you're going to, of necessity, have to look for a different breed of man in the science. And if you look at the opportunities that the space shuttle offers
for international cooperation, I think that we're going to find that we're going to have foreign scientists not only devising the experiments as they did on, like the Swiss government did on our solar wind experiment that we've had on the lunar surface, but devising and building and actually performing their experiments in orbit. And in this way, I think that it'll draw nations closer together, because perhaps if we can cooperate in this mutual effort in science, then the political cooperation, which we all desire, will follow.
Any more questions? There's one.
Yeah, undoubtedly, as the space shuttle gets along in the progress, we shall have our ecologists screaming about upper atmosphere and ionospheric pollution. Is anybody doing anything now to get ready for this?
Yeah, how about having the rocket engines produce water? We're not really...
But water is a danger in the SST, so they say. What I'm trying to say here is, hadn't we better get ready for this kind of criticism by killing it and nipping it in the bud?
Okay, the answer is we are preparing. We are preparing for that. We are looking at things like what really is the sound pollution of this supersonic bird coming back from both stages, coming back from their mission. Where will that shockwave impinge on the Earth, and how can we minimize it? What are the aspects of water vapor at what altitudes? And we are looking at it, and we're preparing, if you will, to answer those questions.
Could you give us some preliminary answers at this point?
I'd rather not.
Are you optimistic? Does it look good or bad? What?
I live in optimism. Yes.
Now's the time to tell the public.
Yes, I understand. It's a matter of, let me be direct if I can. It's a matter of, should I be waving the red cape at the bull before he gets in the ring, or should I let him get in the ring first and wave the red cape at him? I think I'd prefer to let him get in the ring first.
Well, whoever finally builds this space shuttle has got to get the money from the same Congress that has defeated the SST and cut back the space program. What are you going to do to change the somewhat anti-technology position that Congress apparently now has? What do you think ought to be done? Not necessarily you. People like you.
I think that you're hitting on it. We have to get to the public. We have to convince them that we're not the great polluters of this earth, that there really is a place for those kind of things, as well as technology, and that it's not the bit of technology against the culture of man, but it's more how do you harness it for mankind. You heard part of that down in Phoenix, I hope, if any of you attended that session, of our attempts to get to the public. We're going to try more of those. When I talk about bulls and red flags, what I'd like very much to do is to get to our congressmen before we carry this flaming message over their heads to the public. And I'd like very much to do it in that sequence. At least that's our battle plan, if you will. And I can be succinct as calling it a battle plan. We're looking at it that way.
Actually, you're making a comparison there that I don't think is quite true either. You were comparing the SST with the space shuttle, and there is a difference, and our job is to make sure that the difference is known.
I was talking about attitudes such as Mr. Proxmire's, and so on. I'm not comparing the two.
Are there any other questions?
Yeah. Yes, with respect to the two Phase B contractors and then also Grumman, presumably a contract will eventually go to one of these three to design an orbiter vehicle and then another team however they do it, for the booster, and which would mean the other contestants would be out of the contest and for the only big space program in town. And I just wondered if you saw any organizational arrangement whereby McDonnell Douglas and Grumman and North American could all share in this one program. I know that McDonnell Douglas had talked about such a super prime, I believe it was, some weeks ago.
May I turn your eyes to the right, over to Wayne Coons, who's representative from NASA, from Houston, the Manned Spacecraft Center. Could you answer that, Wayne? I think that's more the evaluation and the decision will be coming out of NASA.
Yes, I can try to answer it. We will, sometime late this summer, request proposals from the industry on the orbiter element of the system and on the booster element of the system. And the total aerospace industry will be invited to propose. It's, of course, up to each corporation to determine how they will propose and on what they will propose. The engine contracts are currently being, they're in procurement now. The proposals have been received from the industry for the engine.
Yeah, well, that wasn't the answer to my question. My question was, for example, could two companies conceivably participate? Presumably you would give the contract for the orbiter only to one company, not to both McDonnell Douglas and North American. Could there be any arrangement where one of them could possibly make the structures for it and the other one could make another massive part of it?
I thought I had answered that. Yes, it's up to the companies to determine how they will propose, and that would include teaming arrangements.
If you look at the Apollo program, you'll see that at one time there were 20,000 subcontractors out, and would follow that subcontracting would be a plan of action for the company that was eventually awarded the prime contract.
It's a little early. The major contestants are jockeying not for second and third position, but for first position. And they're not going to select one winner and all the rest losers. They're going to pick a leader of the orbiter, and the business is going to be, to a fair extent, passed out among the other people in the form of subcontracts. And it's a little early to talk about what that structure is right now.
Just as an amplification on that, just on the Apollo program, the command module program alone, some 49% of the dollars that we received on it went out to subcontracting personnel. If there are no other questions, I think we can adjourn. I would like to introduce the NASA resident manager here at Downey. That's Ford Miller. He's sitting in the back. We also have Don Green from NASA's PIO in Houston, and our own public relations people, Dave Alder, Tony Longo, Bob Eggert, Gordon Gray. And with that, we thank you for coming. And I might add also here that this is really our workroom. You can look around. We have the service module with the SIM package for Apollo 15. We have a